Hello, welcome to Grumpy Strategists, episode 25. Grumpy Strategists is the podcast of Strategic Analysis Australia. I'm Michael Shoebridge and I'm joined by SAA's Head of Research, Dr. Marcus Hellyer.
Hello, Michael.
So, Marcus, this is the one-year anniversary of the Grumpy Strategist podcast.
Wow,
so
we're a year
happy
old.
Happy birthday to you as a fellow grumpy person.
Happy birthday to you. Time flies when you're having fun.
Yeah.
And it has been fun.
It has. A year on, so much has changed. And
Okay, I like your optimism, young man.
And here we are talking about the Army and their new plan with the National Defence Strategy. It's Land Forces time, big conference happening just this week that we're recording this down in Melbourne. A whole lot of protesters against the weapons industry turning up, but a whole lot of machines and people in green. And of course, a year on, we started the podcast talking about submarines. We've got some more information about nuclear submarines, Australian plans and UK troubles. So it's really Army and then submarines.
Yeah, I feel we've sort of neglected Army a bit in the last year, but it's Land Forces Week. I'm going to go down there. So if anybody is listening and bumps into me, say hi. If you object to anything that we've said, it's probably something that Michael said. So don't get grumpy at me, but I'll be there. Be nice to meet people. If you see me, I'm on the illustration on the website. I'm the good-looking one of the two.
Oh, on the brochure?
Yeah.
Oh, no, on the grumpy strategist.
Yeah. I'm the good-looking one.
I thought you were saying you were the face of Land Forces.
So they're not that desperate. And then I have to be back because big day Friday, I'm going to see Iron Maiden up in Sydney. So it is a huge week.
Iron Maiden, of course, is bringing a sort of heavy armor flavor in, even if it's a band. So I like the connections you're making. So the Army is heading off down to this conference. No doubt there'll be a whole lot of senior Army officers talking and strolling around looking at machines they'd like to buy. And just before this, they've released this document about Army's contribution to the National Defence Strategy. I've had a read, you've had a read. Mm-hmm. My initial thought is it's good they put something out publicly. It's good that they feel a need to show how they're working with the broader strategy released by the government. But I felt it was a bit like the ghost of Christmas past wrapped up as something brand new. And that's mainly by repeating the word littoral all the time.
Yeah, so there's good and bad here, I think. So, yes, it's a good thing there that they're talking about littoral operations. To me, the messaging is, yes, we heard the DSR, we've heard what the government accepted the recommendations of the DSR, and so this is what we're doing about it, and so we're now very littoral focused. You know, I guess that's a good thing, I guess. It's a bit harder to see the other big new bit in there. So the other big new bit was the Army's going to get a lot of long-range strike weapons, and so it's going to move from kind of close combat kind of expertise. So they're saying they're not giving that up.
Yep, but it was all about combined arms and the close fight before, really.
Yeah, so now the combined arms construct is different because now the combined arms construct includes a whole bunch of long-range strike weapons. And so they're sort of moving from that 5x5 kilometer box to something potentially 500x500 kilometers. And that's sort of sitting in there, but I'm not really seeing how that's getting directly addressed. And I suspect that's in part because Army is really still working through this fundamental change of scope.
This is what I meant by it's the ghost of Christmas past, because my view of the previous plan, the Beersheba plan, which had so much heavy armor involved, was about our Army identifying itself as a sort of small plug-in version of the big US Army. And the thing that Army leaders in recent decades have hated is the idea they might have to be a bit more like the Marine Corps and a bit less like the big US Army, because the US Army is a serious army, and to be an army, you've got to be like them. But when I look at this new document, it still looks a bit like we still want to be like that big US Army, but we want to get places in landing craft.
Yeah, so to me it is still very, there are a lot of similarities. They haven't sort of chucked this all out and said we're going to be the Australian Marine Corps. The language is still very kind of land focused. It's just the bits of land we're going to be operating on are littoral.
They're smaller
bits of
and
land.
Wetter. Yeah.
So I don't think much has fundamentally changed in this. Now, again, I'm just going by this public document, but you look at the kinds of language being used, that, you know, land warfare is all about controlling the population, and so wars are going to take place in cities. And so in some ways, very similar to what came before. But yes, there is a kind of recognition here that where we're going to be operating will be sort of further out. So the maps are of the island chains to our north, for example. But again, it's not the US Marine Corps concept, because the new US Marine Corps concept really does see itself working as part of a broader kind of maritime warfare concept. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, the Marine Corps will be kind of an adjunct to the Navy, sort of mini unsinkable aircraft carriers or mini unsinkable.
They're unsinkable because launches. They're on a little island, but then they're not going to stay on the same island for very long. They're going to hop across somewhere else, but they're not sinkable like a ship. There's none of that flavour in this document. In fact, I couldn't see much that's integrated here. They talk about how the Army's one of five domains and therefore they're integrated because they're one of the five integrated domains. They talk about how they're part of the integrated focus force, but then they talk about their contribution to the integrated focus force is to do land combat, which again doesn't really give you that. How are they seriously taking their maritime strike role, which some of these big systems that are coming, like HIMARS firing prism weapons, precision strike missiles, that is, I think, all about a maritime role. But you wouldn't know that. All the words are used about how they're going to be integrated, but there's nothing here that really says they're going to do anything other than what you'd traditionally expect an army to do, doing land battle.
Mm. Yeah, so I think it is, there's encouraging stuff there, but I think it is a bit half pregnant. So still caught between the older view of what they do and this sort of new kind of concept that the DSR was aiming
at. And to be fair, maybe it has to be like that because they talk about one of their primary strengths for the army, which is how well-trained and how agile and flexible and adaptive their people are. And the contrast to me is, well, their people might be agile and adaptive, but their structure sure as hell isn't. It's like this oil tanker that they've put the brakes on that still hasn't slowed down much. So all the things that they're getting are things that were thought of 10, 15, 20 years ago and are now starting to turn up. Meanwhile, the direction for the whole plan has changed. So the only flexibility, it turns out, is in the people.
Yeah, so it rightly emphasizes, you know, that people are the most important resource they have and they're flexible and agile. But yes, that's because the materiel side of things is still so achingly slow. So there is a nice little graphic there showing what equipment is coming and when it's meant to turn up, and you go, yeah, all of this stuff has been part of the plan for years and years and years, and most of it we haven't gotten yet. We haven't even started to get a lot of it yet. So we've moved from Plan Beersheba to a new force structure, which was actually the one before Plan Beersheba, where the three combat brigades were all somewhat different. So a lot of the stuff we ordered probably doesn't quite fit anymore. No. So anyway, that's a bit of a free kick because Army's really no different from the other services in that regard. But the other thing that I sort of have some concerns about in this document is there's some interesting historical narratives there and harking back to World War II and the very large amphibious operations that the Australian Army was doing in World War II. The thing is, however, back then we had many divisions. We had an army of hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people. And what I'm missing in this document is how we get from our very small professional army to that much larger army that will probably be required if we have major conflict in the Indo-Pacific. And there's still this is a document that essentially talks about a small, highly professional, highly capable, highly trained army. And I really don't see any kind of change in thinking about mobilization. So how do we move from the previous 50 years of contributions, small contributions to wars of choice, to an army that needs to generate massive contributions?
It's not even like that thinking might be being done and they're going to tell us what the result is sometime. They actually continue to say that for them, asymmetry means they're a small force that's agile and highly technically capable, and therefore they're able to move quickly where larger forces that they might oppose can't. So they're saying, actually, we're just going to make a virtue out of the fact that we're small. But there's no answer to when they lose great chunks of this small force, what happens then? And that's because the answer is, then we lose. Yeah. So yes, they have not engaged with the problem that they're going to be fighting peer or near-peer adversaries who have bigger scale than they do, and they have no plan to be able to continue to fight when they take combat losses.
Yes, I have to say, it's all well and good to have your little historical anecdotes from World War II, but the good guys won World War II because they had a lot more stuff and they could churn out a lot more stuff a lot more quickly. Yep. On an individual one-for-one basis, it's hard to really distinguish between the good guys and the bad guys.
Well, I think both the Japanese and the Germans showed in the second half of the war that soldier for soldier, they fought incredibly well with an asymmetric disadvantage in materiel terms. So the lesson to me is, yes, smaller forces can be agile, but mass really matters and a flow of material really matters. And nothing in this plan shows me that the army is thinking about those things.
No, I presented today, I gave a lecture and, you know, raised all of the standard grumpy strategist themes there about exquisite forces and the cost capability death spiral that most Western militaries are in. And quite rightly, somebody asked, well, what's the solution? And I said, well, it's difficult, but I think you need to start with the idea of simplifying. Ooh. Simplifying so you can make stuff faster, you can equip people faster, you can train them faster, you can recruit them and get them to the level that they're useful faster. And I think we're still heading in the opposite trajectory. So yeah. Overall, I think interesting document, but where it's halfway there, but it doesn't quite get there.
I think it shows how difficult change is in large bureaucratic institutions. So hopefully they're thinking through some of these things and we'll see some of that evidence in something else, but it's not in this.
Yes, and that line I saw about how difficult changes in large organisations, particularly military ones, was used in the final report of the Royal Commission into Veteran Suicide that came out today. And we'll cover it, not today. I don't think we've had enough time to really go through it and digest it.
No, look, I think that is a big...
We will be coming back to it.
It's a big defining issue for our military services and for our defence organisation and the Veterans Affairs organisation that supports them. But, you know, to take it with the seriousness that we need, I think we've got to digest that.
Yep. Yeah.
So another document, this turns out to be a document-based podcast, is the Australian Submarine Agency's corporate plan 2024 to 2028. I thought again when I saw this thing, this is really against the run of play. We're getting some transparency and openness from a part of the defence organisation. Let's see what this plan is.
Are you being ironic here, Michael?
Well, that's what I thought before I read it. And then even from the first page, I realised what it was. And it's a minimum compliance document for legal purposes, because right at the start it recites the laws that they have to comply with that has meant they have to put this plan together. And then the thing itself is as thin as possible, doing just enough to not go to jail for not meeting minimum legal requirements.
Yes, I think this is box ticking in action. And I have to say, when I looked at this, it transported me back to my days in defence, of all of this kind of busy work you have to do to meet legislative requirements while not actually generating anything of any use to anybody, not even really the primary customer of this, which is really the government and the Parliament of Australia. I'm not sure what anybody in Parliament actually does with this to learn anything useful.
I knew what this was going to do and how bad it was going to be when I read this sentence from Director General Meade's foreword, which of course comes after the Deputy Prime Minister and also Minister responsible for Defence's foreword, Richard Miles. But this is Vice Admiral Jonathan Meade. I'm pleased to present the 2024 to 2028 ASA corporate plan as required under paragraph 35(1)(b) of the Public Governance Performance and Accountability Act 2013, in accordance with section 16(e) of the Public Governance Performance and Accountability Rule 2014, followed by his signature.
Yes, well, the point of this, my understanding of the point of these corporate plans, so all agencies have to do it, is you put out the portfolio budget statements, which essentially say, here's all the dollars and here's what you're meant to achieve with the dollars. And these plans are meant to translate that into, here's all the things we're going to do.
This is what we're doing with the money to achieve the results. Yeah.
But you, having looked at Defence's corporate plans, and after kind of stabbing my eyeballs out and trying to make sense of it, they really don't say anything particularly useful. But it is the corporate plan which is used as a basis of agency self-assessment in their annual report to say whether they performed.
Yeah.
And since if you set the bar extremely low, surprise, surprise, they all come back and say, we hit our performance targets.
That's right. Well, that brings me to what they've said about their targets. So they have some targets in here. And when I think about a target, normally a target
SMART.
Is SMART. In fact, there's an acronym about SMART, Objective SMART Targets. Well,
something specific.
Well, SMART stands for these things. It's a SMART target or objective if it's specific, if it's measurable, if it's achievable, if it's relevant, and if it's time-bounded. You need all those elements because otherwise there's nothing for you to measure your performance against. And when I look at the targets in this performance framework and measures, which is on page 24 of a 32-page document, none of them have any of these attributes of being specific, measurable, achievable, maybe relevant is one, but time-bound. So there's a couple of my favourites. Do you have a favourite you'd like to mention?
Oh, well, maybe? It's not so much a target, but it's in the risk section. So there is a page on key risks. And so one...
need to be specific and
measurable. Is around infrastructure. So it says the risk is the ASA is unable to deliver the necessary infrastructure required to achieve the pathway. I mean, yes, that's a key risk. If you haven't got a shipyard, you can't build submarines or you can't maintain them. So the management of this is the ASA engages in close partnership with Australian industry to develop and deliver fit-for-purpose infrastructure. So that's our mitigation strategy, is we're going to work with industry to build infrastructure. To manage the risk, we won't have infrastructure.
So on that, if I was thinking about specific, measurable, achievable, relevant and time bound, I'd be thinking, so you need to name some of the key blobs of infrastructure you need, like a dry dock, a ship lift, maybe the East Coast base. You need to talk about the time.
Shipyard.
Shipyard. You may need to talk about the time you need them to be operating.
The workforce you need to do it. Pathway.
The critical path involving getting a site identified and an infrastructure proposal through the parliament, through the public works committee.
Maybe doing some geological survey so we don't have a rerun of Snowy Hydro.
Maybe some of the standards you need to construct them to, and if the UK experience is replicated here, there will be new construction standards that we don't build things to in this country around things like the ability of these nuclear-capable facilities able to withstand earthquakes, even if those earthquakes are highly unexpected in our country.
Yeah, so I say let's move on from bashing up the ASA's corporate plan, because we could do the same to pretty much any government agency.
Well,
but we are moving into sort of the optimal pathway itself. And we recently heard from Chief of Navy that, don't worry, 18 months down the path from the original announcement, everything is on track. And I just go, how are we meant to know that? Because we don't actually know what the track is. So all of those things, bits of infrastructure you just mentioned, I have seen no statement about what actually are those bits of infrastructure. So we know the UK has had a lot of trouble keeping its SSNs at sea. In fact, they haven't had any at sea. Part of that problem is not enough sustainment infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
So I've seen nothing to say, what do we think is the sustainment infrastructure we need for our SSN force? So the UK has meant to have 7 SSNs, 4 SSBNs, 11 submarines. My understanding is they have 4 or 5 dry docks for sustainment, and then they also have a separate ship
production
lift.
Facility.
So we're talking 4 or 5 very, very, very large bits of infrastructure for 11 submarines. We're getting 8. So you've got to think we're going to need at least 3 or 4 large dry docks just for sustainment.
Well, and the British are having trouble keeping their dry docks functional for these nuclear submarines. That's partly because some of them are quite old, and it's also partly because when they've got new designs, they need to change the configuration, and it's because the regulatory and safety standards are getting harder and harder.
So, Michael, did you say that if you have two different kinds of SSN, the infrastructure for one may not work for the other one?
I did indeed. That seems to be the UK experience.
So who else do you know that will have two separate classes of SSNs?
Yes.
Plus a colon. Yeah. So Eddie, I guess the point is I don't know, how do you assess whether the optimal pathway is on track when none of the deliverables needed to deliver that path, achieve that pathway, have actually been announced than we're going to have some sub-rains at some point?
Well, I looked, that's why the targets are so important, but the targets are just statements of the obvious without anything measurable or specific. So performance measure 3 is deliver Australian-built SSN AUKUS, including infrastructure development of the Osborne Submarine Construction Node. Targets: manage and oversee the development of the enabling works for the nuclear-powered submarine construction yard in Adelaide, South Australia. That sounds like the performance measure repeated. Establish the arrangements necessary to mobilise the program. And then the last target apparently is develop the nuclear-powered submarine industrial uplift strategy. None of these are targets. So you cannot tell if they're meeting them. We just need to rely on their own assertions that they're meeting the things
Is so incredibly circular. It's like, well, we're going to need some infrastructure. Okay, so how are we going to do that? Well,
we're going to get some infrastructure.
We're going to build some infrastructure. How are we going to build some infrastructure? Well, we'll talk with the infrastructure builders.
Yeah. This is not giving any public confidence in this enterprise, to my mind. And it should be a serious endeavour to demonstrate why we can trust them to deliver. No, I'm not getting that message.
You know, and that's the thing. So when we look at the Australian National Audit Office's major projects report each year, we actually get some detail around major projects. And we have got nothing comparable to the biggest defence project, probably the biggest Australian project ever. We have nothing comparable. So all of these statements about we're on track are essentially meaningless at this point.
Well, and I'm sure we'll hear, well, the reason I can't give you any of this detail is because it's all super highly classified. Surely you understand that because you're talking about nuclear technology, the crown jewels that have to be protected. All I would say to that is, well, both the US and UK seem to be able to be much more transparent about these things. And in fact, anyone that reads this very fine UK publication, the Navy Lookout, that is replete with dates, details and activities around all of these issues when it comes to the UK submarines. So it is absolutely possible. It's just not something we're seeing from our submarine agents.
Yeah, Navy Lookout is great. It's a site I've been reading for quite a long time now, and it's done by former Royal Navy personnel. And so, you know, they're not trying to undermine the Royal Navy.
Well, they are very pro the Royal Navy.
They want a strong Navy. So you can point out problems, you can point out risks, you can point out missed targets, and you're not somehow a foreign stooge or you've fallen for the foreign propagandist's line.
I think it does excellent work. And for those interested in what operating nuclear submarines looks like and what are the very practical challenges, I think they're an excellent source. So we'll put a link to a couple of their more recent calls with the podcast. But they look back about the extremely low availability that the Royal Navy's had out of its attack submarines. And they look at what might be changing, maybe improving a bit. To me, Marcus, the summary is their old nuclear submarine, the last of the Trafalgar class, is the one that has been the workhorse of the Royal Navy's attack submarines. The Astute class, well, they're still finishing off one of them. They're just accepting another one. But the others have been out of action for a long chunk of time now.
Yeah, so a year ago, they put out a report that said that none of the Royal Navy's attack submarines, so there were six of them at that point, none of them are at sea. So we often say, well, there's a 3-to-1 rule. If you've got three of something, you can have one reliably deployed. So with six Collins, we're meant to have two at sea.
Yep.
Well, with six SSNs, the UK couldn't get any to sea.
Yeah.
So that was a year ago. Navy Lookout's done an update and it's sort of got a little bit better. So they say of the Royal Navy six SSNs currently in commission, only one has been to sea in the last 3 months. So that's not hugely inspiring, I have to say. And as you say, the one that has made it to sea is the oldest of the lot, the one that's about to be retired and replaced by a new Astute.
Yes. And in fact, the oldest one, that HMS Triumph, I think, isn't it? It had spent over 4 years in a revalidation and assisted maintenance period before that. So, yes, it's available now, but it was out of action.
After four years of surgery to get it through its golden last few golden years. So, to me, the kind of really depressing thing here is the Astutes. So, there's five of them currently in service, another two meant to be entering service soon. They didn't get to see it all. And they're not old boats. So the oldest of the Astutes, HMAS Astute, is only about 14 or 15 years old. So you can't really blame their age. And Navy Lookout says, you know, while they are fine boats, the Astutes, their maintenance demands appear to be high with not enough attention paid to through-life sustainment during their design. This has been compounded by a lack of foresight and investment in submarine support infrastructure. So there you go. There's two big lessons that when we're designing SSN
Snorkers,
it has to be designed for sustainment. And now everybody always says that when they design a new system, but it never really seems to happen. And the other thing is we need to design the sustainment infrastructure. And as we were talking about earlier, it's not clear what that is in our case.
Well, and it's some of the longest lead activity you can have. Like, you know, 20 years to build a big new facility, and longer if it's to be in a new site, would be a reasonable time frame. Yeah.
And the other thing that Navy Lookout say is that because of this lack of activity, it has an impact on submariners because you're not getting to sea, you're not training them, they're not maintaining their qualifications. And they describe this as a worst of both worlds situation where they have too much time ashore, lacking challenge and excitement, with skills perishing without live training. And to me, this is going to be one of the huge challenges as we go through our submarine transition, as the Collins age. How are we going to get people to sea on the aging Collins boats to keep their skills up and to generate the much larger number of submariners we need for the SSN fleet?
Unless they're all crewing parts of American submarines, of course.
Well, that does seem to be the strategy at the moment.
But the flip side of this low availability is, yes, you've got crews sitting around wondering what they're doing because there's no submarine to go to sea. But then for when a submarine is available, they get chronically overworked and burnt out. I actually think we're seeing that happen in the surface fleet in the Navy right now with ANZAC crews. It's burnout, and that causes a whole set of cascading troubles in your workforce because you lose some of the people in critical trades that you can't afford not to have.
And I think another lesson from this piece is that they're not getting their submarines to sea, which creates what they call a large gap in the UK's maritime shield. So it says, arguably the nation's most potent conventional assets, they are needed to protect the nuclear deterrent, so the SSBNs, hunt other submarines, hold adversary warships at risk, and conduct intelligence gathering. Well, if they're meant to be doing all of that stuff to protect the UK, but they're not getting boats to sea, so I just can't see any way that the UK is going to be able to deploy an SSN to Australia for Submarine Rotation Force West. I mean, that's meant to be happening in a few years' time. I cannot see it happening.
If Vladimir Putin wasn't the ruler of Russia and they weren't currently being obviously extraordinarily aggressive and militaristic, there would be some chance of that. But I can't see that stopping over the time frame of now and when we're meant to see UK submarines permanently floating off Perth.
No. So if we go back to my great hero, Bent Flivberg, you know, who says...
The new Flivberg was going to find his
way. He's got to get mentioned. Mega projects generally fail to deliver against cost, schedule and capability. So the lesson here is we've been focusing so much on, will we get the first submarine in 2032? Will the US hand it over to us? But I think the lesson here is, even when you get the stuff, it can be sort of profoundly disappointing.
Very hard to put to work. And you can find, even when you've got them, you don't really have any that you can use for a whole bunch of strange and what look at the time like indirect reasons.
You know, so when are we actually going to have real capability? Getting three Virginias may not actually give us a real capability if the UK is struggling to get one boat to sea with six submarines.
Well, I'd love to see some of those targets in the next version of the Australian Submarine Agency's corporate plan.
And I would say, this is probably a separate rant that we'll come back to, I think the Australian strategic policy community has really under-delivered in its analysis of AUKUS. We've sort of defaulted to the kind of pro stuff, which is this is great and it's going to enhance the alliance. At the other end, you've got the, well, this is just making us lackeys of the Americans and it'll drag us into war off Taiwan. Yeah. And there's very little solid analysis of the kind you see in Navy Lookout of actual implementation. Yeah. Now, part of that is the issue we've just spoken about. Well, what are we actually analyzing? Because there's no detail around the plan. But I'm not seeing a lot of sort of analysis of how is this going to work? What are the risks and around delivering this? And so I think the Australian strategic policy community, whether you're think tanks, academia,
yeah,
commentators, have still got a long way to go in this. But we'll come back to that later.
We will. We will. Well, Marcus, happy birthday to the podcast. Hope you enjoy Land Forces. I'm looking forward to a Grumpy Strategist podcast. It can actually be quite a cheery, encouraging one. So maybe that's something to look for over this next year. Thanks, Marcus.
Okay.